The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's episode includes some distressing animal content. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners. I'm Eric Peabody, and this is the Horror Hill Podcast. Tonight's episode includes three stories for you, cultivated from the dark soil of the internet. With a slate this full, let's just get a quick intro here before we dig into our sumptuous feast. What do you say? To open, we'll be reading Dog People by Jay Lugo, where a young assistant at an animal rescue shelter starts noticing some odd details about their strays. Next, we'll jump into Rorschach and Tea Leaves by Raz T. Slasher, in which a group of college kids exploring an abandoned amusement park make a very unexpected discovery. Lastly, we have Mr. Jones and You, also by Raz T. Slasher, where a quiet voice from your childhood, yes, listener, your childhood, speaks up for the first time in years. It's quite a delightful little spread we have, isn't it? You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Jay Lugo, I give you Dog People. I've seen puncture wounds on just about every part of a dog, but nothing, and I mean nothing, bleeds like a split ear. While there are several ways to wrap an ear, I prefer to bend at the natural seam and wrap the bandage around the entire head. This method discourages the dog from picking at the wrap and minimizes discomfort. Dogs will always choose normalcy over their well-being. That's where a balance of human intervention and cooperation becomes necessary. This stray was brought in by the street guys, Peter and Paul, our canine-catching team of exactly two. Peter and Paul don't suffer from your average identical sibling rivalry. They got hired as a pair, work most of the same shifts, and just about split a paycheck. The rescue isn't exactly well-funded, but we get by on a lot of passion and legwork. The split ear, which runs from the center and divides the ear in two, like ribbons, isn't the last of the stray's problems, but it is the most urgent. Enough blood has dripped onto the examination table to create a steady trickle onto the floor. I take a step back to avoid getting it on my shoes. A visible urge runs up the dog's spine, then around its broad neck. "He's going to shake," I say, but no one listens to us in Richmond, guys. The head veterinarian, Dr. Mackney, is measuring out her third bandage in as many minutes, and she's scrunching her face as if my suggestion is an affront to her years of schooling. It's an interesting dog, a lab mix with wire hair. Huge, but with nothing behind its eyes. I reload some peanut butter onto my spoon, which momentarily staves off the head shake. Then I drop the spoon, breaking its trance. His neck stiffens again. "He's going to shake," I repeat. But it's too late, and the dog ripples with kinetic force. With the urge relieved, the dog's tongue hangs proudly. The doctor removes her glasses, which are now dotted with crimson flecks, along with every surface in a 4-foot radius. I hold up a fresh, new dollop of peanut butter. "One more try?" I ask. Later that day, I'm out in the daycare yard overseeing a group of 4 for social hour. The group consists of Rocky, the house mutt, a boxer named Champ, and 2 Staffordshire Terrier mixes named Luna. Rocky sits at my side watching the rest of the group like a retired athlete, wondering if he's got one more game left in him. In a past life, Rocky was a bait dog, a chew toy used to foster aggression in tougher dogs. Probably the runt of his litter, or a genetic mistake that canceled out his killer instincts. His ears are cropped so close to his skull that all that remains are 2 tufts of hair that have thickened in his golden years, giving him the appearance of a mad scientist or an inbred marmoset. A muscular tongue dangles over his stalagmite teeth, and the corners of his mouth are pulled into a wide grin. Champ is off in the corner of the fenced-off yard, scratching his back against the artificial turf and tanning his belly in the July sun. I want what he has, that unbothered look. Dogs don't test Champ, but they don't fear him either. His existence lies somewhere between the sun and that flea and tick-resistant turf, which is good enough for both of us. The bullies have had a slow start. This is their 3rd meeting so far, the 2nd of which ended abruptly after Luna 2 stiffened up and started growling. Today, we've made some progress, with Luna 2 even engaging in bursts of play. She gets herself into a push-up position and looks up at Luna 1. A dog's behavior can teach you plenty about life, if you're dumb enough or weird enough to comprehend the lesson. By my count, a dog only feels one of 5 things at any given time. Their primary colors are happiness, discomfort, fear, hunger, or lust. People like to overcomplicate things with degrees and medical jargon, but they aren't the ones picking up shit or breaking up fights. The real dog people know better. Dogs are simple, but people aren't. After the blood shower in the examination room, Dr. Mackney asked the staff to stay late for a deep clean. Gwen from the grooming department has stopped by to help. She takes care of the walls while I disinfect the kennels and remove hair from their rolling feet with a vintage sterling silver pocket knife. "I'm heading to the lamb tonight," she says, apropos of nothing. She's referring to a small bar on Main Street, the sort of place with classic rock and darts during the week and DJs and college crowds all weekend. "That's cool," I say. "Have fun." Gwen laughs, but I don't know why. After the deep clean, I hand my keys to the overnight employee, a late teenage girl who surveils the dogs on an hourly basis or between rounds of homework. She waves me goodbye in a way that manages to feel unfriendly, and I make my way to the bus bench across the street. My bus is 24 minutes away, but I've brought a book, and I welcome the isolation and the summer night's breeze. I open the cover and find my place, and within moments, the Westchester County back streets evaporate and are replaced by the high, guarded walls of my fantasy novel's kingdom. The hero of the novel has just discovered the full scope of the looming threat and retreats to his garden to ponder his options. The writer embellishes with thick descriptions of lush gardens where flowers display a degree of sentience. The hero looks to the sky and the moose call horn of a Honda Accord erupts through the quiet street and nearly jolts me off the bench. Gwen looks over from her driver's seat. "The lamb," she says. "Are you coming or what?" Gwen's radio is turned down, and I miss the rustle of the breeze and the cicadas' songs as soon as the door is fully shut. "I'm glad you're coming," Gwen says. "I've been trying to get you out for months." "You have?" I ask, but my attention veers to the passenger side mirror, where a white van careens dangerously into the first spot outside the rescue. I recognize the Italian flag backdrop of the license plate. Then, both doors swing open, and two short, identical, muscular men emerge from either side. Peter is wearing a plain black t-shirt that appears damp even in the low light. A tan-colored gauze is wrapped tightly around his left bicep, with prominent rust-colored stains throughout. His gold chain, a massive Cuban link with a diamond-encrusted microphone pendant, swings wildly as he sprints to the rear of the van. His brother, Paul, meets him there, and they disappear from my view. "It's kind of late for a drop-off," I say. "Do you know if anybody called in any strays?" "Who cares?" Gwen says. "And no work talk once we get to the bar." And she puts the car in drive and coasts away. At the Lamb, Gwen fumbles through a series of interrogation-style questions that fill me with unease. "What do you do for fun?" she asks. "I don't know," I respond. "I mostly just read and go to work." Gwen laughs, and for the second time tonight, I'm confused. A few tables over, a tall guy wearing a college sweatshirt loudly teases his friend, causing the table to erupt in laughter and applause. "You're so boring," she exclaims. "I'm sorry," I reply. "No, don't be sorry. I meant, like, it's cute." Gwen stares at me for long enough that the grip on my pint glass weakens. In the dim lights, I first notice that Gwen has freckles and a perfectly straight smile. I'm relieved when a loud commotion diverts both of our attentions once again to the table of collegiate boys. "Why are you acting like such a pussy?" Sweatshirt demands. He's staring down at a skinny, smaller boy in a dress shirt. The boy in the dress shirt is studying his drink, while the other occupants at the table laugh and exchange animated glances. "I said, why are you acting like a little bitch?" Sweatshirt doubles down. Dress shirt says something inaudible to me, and without a moment's hesitation, Sweatshirt smacks him with enough follow-through to relocate him to the edge of his seat. Gwen gasps from somewhere behind me, but it's swallowed up by the explosive din of a fully enthralled crowd. People laugh and cheer as Sweatshirt closes in on his friend and grabs the collar of his shirt, snapping the top buttons off. Dress Shirt pushes a hand against Sweatshirt's face in an attempt to create distance. Sweatshirt cocks an arm back for a punch, but he's grabbed at the elbow and then around the neck by a slab of muscle in a black security shirt. "We were just fucking around," he pleads as the bouncer shoves him past our table and toward the door. I look over at Gwen. Her face has reddened, significantly reducing the contrast of her freckles. I think I see tears in her eyes, but I'm not sure. "I'm sorry," she says. "We should have gone somewhere else." "Why are you sorry?" I ask. "It just seems like you're having a bad time," she says. "I'm not having a bad time," I say. "I just don't do this very often." "Kids are so stupid," she says. "Why would you pick a fight with your own friend?" "Predatory drift," I answer. Gwen squints at me. "Dave, I thought I said no work stuff," she says, but I can tell she's joking this time. "It's sort of like when two dogs play, they're actually just testing one another. You know, who's faster, who's stronger, who would win in a real fight, that sort of thing," I begin. "But sometimes, with a more dominant dog, you get these bad instincts, and they kick in if the other dog shows real weakness. Like, if you can't keep up and you can't play..." And I pause to choose my next words carefully. Then you're prey, Gwen concludes. We finish our drinks in comfortable silence, then pay up our tab. Back in Gwen's car and with work talk back on the menu, conversation flows freely. Gwen asks if I want to come over and watch a movie, and I agree. We chat as we pass the quiet suburbia of Pelham Road, then onto the heavily forested, sparsely lamp-lit glow of Shore Road on the border between New Rochelle and the Bronx. As houses and taverns are traded for trees and horse stables, I realize that I'm comfortable around another person for the first time in my adult life. "What about Dennis?" she asks. "Who?" "That guy with the silly tattoo of the sun with sunglasses?" "Oh," I remember. "What about him?" "He was just so weird," she says. "He wasn't weird, just quiet," I answer. "But to answer your question, he stopped showing up about a month ago. It doesn't surprise me either. He was the only guy who Dr. Mackney treated worse than me." "Yeah, what's her deal with you anyway?" Gwen asks. "I'm not sure," I say, "but that isn't true. The truth is that she doesn't respect me or anyone without a degree in the field." I look out my window. A chain-link fence becomes visible in a gap amid the tree line. Far beyond that fence are several miles of golf course. But directly beyond that fence, and only barely visible in the dying glow of a far-ahead street lamp, are three sets of green eyes focused on my side of the vehicle. Around the eyes, I can make out the jagged silhouette of thick, spiky fur and sharply pointed ears. I stare back curiously, but a sharp jerk of the steering wheel sends my concentration to the front windshield. "What's wrong?" I ask. "It was a dead deer or something. It was too dark to see until I got close." I look back at the tree line, and just as it ends, a lane of parkway begins. In Gwen's neighborhood, we circle for nearly 15 minutes before a spot opens up several blocks from her apartment. "It's a few blocks this way," she says, and motions with her chin. It's late, but the neighborhood bustles loudly into the summer night with car stereos playing loud music and older men sitting in beach chairs and drinking beer on the sidewalk. We pass a deli and then an old-looking church. A man is lying on his side on the church steps, and he watches us as we walk past.
"That's a pretty girl,"
the man rasps, then lets out a phlegmatic-sounding laugh. Gwen's pace quickens slightly, and her forward gaze becomes rigid.
"I said you're pretty, bitch. Not gonna say thank you?"
Gwen's stride is automatic now, and she rustles her hands in her hoodie pockets. I put an arm around her waist, and her body molds into mine as our steps synchronize. There's a blur to my left, and then the man is in front of us, smiling. His teeth are yellow and jagged, and his mouth stretches far into the sides of his face, giving his nose and jaw a snout-like appearance. He wears an unbuttoned shirt that shows off a topographic map of deep gashes on his torso. A chunk of his arm looks bitten into, giving the flesh the appearance of an apple core. Blood crusts alongside yellow cholesterol deposits on the missing portion of the arm. Gwen is nestled so far under my arm that my heart beats against her face. The man looks her up and down hungrily. He has not regarded me once. For some reason, I think about Rocky, the house mutt. Then, I think about the hero in my novel. I reach for strength that I don't own.
"Leave us alone," I demand.
The man cocks his head back and projects another mucus-filled wheeze. Then, he directs his focus to me, and even with his mouth closed, the lip line stretches for an unpleasant distance across his face. His eyes smolder like a smoking sinkhole as he passes them over me.
"Ugh," he condescends. "Why? What you gonna do about it?"
I place a hand in my pocket and grasp the sterling silver folding knife, allowing the handle to poke visibly next to my waistline. I maintain eye contact as my spine straightens stiff. I concentrate on my breath. Then, I bark.
"Leave us alone,"
I demand again.
or I'll cut your eyes out of your fucking face. I pull the knife fully from my jeans now. The two wide lips creep and curl around the man's cheekbones. Then the smile fades and he studies the blade for a moment.
I'm just fucking with you, yeah?
Then he looks at Gwen.
And it was a fucking compliment. I'll see you around, beautiful.
He looks to his side and then takes off down the church alleyway with alarming momentum. He hops a small fence at the back of the alley and disappears into the night. I look down at Gwen, who is still nestled in my chest. Then she looks up at me.
Let's go, I say, and she blinks out of her trance.
My building is just down the block, she confirms.
We half walk, half jog to the front of her building, where she stops to catch several breaths.
Thank you,
she says, looking me in the eyes. Then she grabs the front of my shirt and kisses me on the front steps under the beautifully full moon. I have an early morning scheduled at the rescue, and Gwen offers to drive me. Something has changed throughout the night, and she touches me frequently and speaks in a softer voice. To my relief, her neighborhood is fast asleep as we approach her parked car.
Thank you again for last night, she says once we're on the road.
It's the dark morning hour when the street lamps are turned off in anticipation of the morning sun. Gwen turns on her brights as she sharply turns onto Shore Road. After a short stretch, we see the culprit of her sharp swerve from the night prior.
Oh my God,
Gwen moans, and we both turn our heads. Beside our vehicle is a mushy pile of blood, bone, and fur organized into a heaping mass. Bits of meat held together by clumps of fur are strewn for several feet of road in either direction. A few feet past that, and a large buck antler becomes visible above the passenger door guardrail like some crude memorial.
What do you think did this?
Gwen asks.
I think about the trio of green eyes, then the man with the wide-set mouth.
I don't know, I say.
We drive in mostly silence, and as we approach the rescue, I'm surprised to see Dr. Mackney's car in the lot. After we pull to a stop, Gwen kisses me goodbye and tells me to call her after work. Then she drives away as I approach the already unlocked front door. The first thing that strikes me is the absence of a night clerk at the front desk. The next thing that strikes me is a small stippling of blood near the door to the hallway. My heart beats with syncopation as I follow its trail to the examination room. As I open the door, I see Dr. Mackney slightly hunched and at eye level with the most grotesquely inbred or birth defective dog that I've ever seen. Its hair is thick at the top of the skull and spine, but sparse elsewhere. I can see bluish-gray skin textured with blood vessels and liver spots through the thinning fur. The joints all twist inward at a point, giving the dog a cracked and hunched appearance. It sits atop an examination table that is not at all raised, suggesting a standing height of approximately 6.5 feet.
Good morning,
I say or ask. Did Peter and Paul drop this stray off? Dr. Mackney doesn't look at me and continues the examination. She peeks in the dog's sharply pointed ears, then pulls back his gums, revealing two rows of strangely uniform, plaque-riddled cuspids.
What are you doing here so early? I ask.
Forgot my purse.
She starts blankly.
Forgot my purse, and what do I walk into?
I'm too confused to respond, so I just stare at the grotesque dog. The lankiness of its limbs should not support its massive center of gravity. Its hackles stand at full attention from a painfully visible spine, and its ribs thump with short, quick breaths. Its jaw is covered in red and dark brown stains, but what draws me are the eyes.
I asked you to deep clean last night, she continues, and somehow you managed to make it worse here. Did you try to redo the bandage on your own?
The dog's deep brown eyes lock onto mine. A depth behind them suggests a level of comprehension beyond sit and stay.
I did deep clean last night, I say. And Gwen from grooming helped me. Dr. Mackney snorts, then forces a chuckle. I never wanted an enrichment division, Dr. Mackney spits. We pay you to what exactly? Play fetch? Clean up shit? And you guys can't even get that right. I took pictures, and I can't wait to send them to the director. She continues speaking, but the canine's eyes snatch my attention mid-sentence. It looks from me to Dr. Mackney with a flick of its eyeballs. Blood vessels constrict in the whites while the pupils burn black with dilation. The eyes bulge in their sockets, eclipsing their depth and singular focus. Dr. Mackney, I interrupt. Don't you speak while I'm speaking? She spits and points a finger at me. I am sick and tired, she continues. The beast's lips curl back, revealing lines of spittle that vibrate like blades of grass against the first visible signs of a deep, gurgling growl. Dr. Mackney, seriously, I start again. What? She yells. He's going to bite! She turns her face just as the hideous beast removes most of her ear with an easy snap of its muscular jaws. Dr. Mackney's scream is high and hysterical as her wide eyes strain to assess her loss. The beast munches hungrily, then swallows. Dr. Mackney is still screaming as the muscles twitch in the beast's neck, and he springs forward with intent. The jaws unhinge, then clamp with force in the same instantaneous beat. Dr. Mackney's right eye socket down to her jawline is ensnared in a craggy prison of yellow teeth. She pulls back reflexively, causing the teeth to sink and lock. The skin from her face stretches, pulls, then shreds like stringy gristle from a butcher's block. The jaws of the beast twitch dutifully, and with a squelching pop, the beast cleans the meat from the bone. The untouched portion of Dr. Mackney's face twists in horror and confusion, while her eyes spin and twitch in their sockets. A gash runs from her inner ear down through what remains of the lobe, which forcefully spurts pints of blood across the examination room. Then, the beast rises deftly to 2 feet and takes the doctor's throat into its maw. He shakes his head once, eliciting a snap, and her body goes limp. I am frozen with fear and confusion as the beast makes eye contact with me. Dr. Mackney hangs heavily from between its jaws as it lowers back onto 4 legs. The beast turns toward me, and I place my palms up defensively. Easy, I command. Easy, boy. I take a step back with my palms still outstretched. We're good. I keep my voice steady. It's okay. The beast walks toward me, dragging Dr. Mackney beside it across the tiled floor. As it steps past me, it looks me in the face. Easy, boy, I repeat. It continues its walk into the hallway, and I slowly shut the door behind it. As the door shuts, I catch one last glimpse of the beast. On the right side of its arm, just visible beneath patchy and thin fur, is a crude outline of a cartoon-style sun wearing sunglasses. The examination room door closes, and from beyond the glass panel, I can see the doors to the hallway open and shut. I still wait painfully for several moments before the main door opens and closes. After the shock dwindles enough for me to regain my faculties, I call the police and then feed my dogs. Rocky smiles when he sees me, and his eyes gleam with admiration as I place the slow feeder on his crate tray. When the cops arrive, they take a quick statement, then I show them footage from the examination room and then the lobby. They exchange worry and confusion-filled glances. The attack footage in the examination room has been conspicuously deleted, but cuts back just in time to place me away from the main computer, as the hallway and lobby footage are also cut. They tell me to leave for the day, as the rescue is deemed an active crime scene. I still need to let my dogs out, I tell them. After some deliberation, a promise from their canine unit, and several neatly scribbled notes about medications, feedings, and temperaments, I finally agree to leave. They tell me that a detective will be in touch with me shortly. As a final word, the officers ask me not to speak with anyone. No problem, I say. My bus is a half an hour away. I want to call Gwen, but she's probably home and in bed by now. With 30 minutes to kill, I take a seat on the bus bench across the street. I fish for my novel, then crack it open across my lap. Maybe I'll finally learn how the hero of this story deals with a looming threat. As I flip for my page, the sharp crack of a twig snags my attention. In the distance behind my bus bench, a group of four massive, grotesquely lanky dogs plod along a tree line across a small parking lot. A glimmer from the fading moon bounces light off a metal object around the neck of the third dog in line. They move with synchronicity, but no urgency, and a calm permeates my spirit as I watch them. As the moon catches off the metallic object again, I get a better glimpse of the small, shiny microphone pendant bouncing with each step. You've been listening to Dog People by Jay Lugo. Jay Lugo is a Bronx-based horror author and enthusiast of all things terrifying. He believes that comedy and horror are blood relatives, and can prove it if you wind him up for a rant. He is currently working on his debut novel. Next up, here's Rorschach and Tea Leaves by Raz T. Slasher. To the uninitiated, Ohio is a prolific Midwestern state. It's the home of aviation, pro baseball, and holds the Hall of Fame for both pro football and rock music, among other things. It boasts the inventions of the light bulb, early motion picture cameras, automobiles, lifesavers, hot dogs, and so much more. Famous people like Steven Spielberg, Wes Craven, Marilyn Manson, Clancy Brown, and so many others began their lives here. To the initiated, however, there's a whole other universe hidden beneath. It's a mecca for all things strange and unusual. I'm talking alien and cryptid sightings galore, serial killers, recorded paranormal activity, vampire cults, regular cults, and more. Even the haunted attraction industry here is the biggest in the world. Basically, if you can name it, you can find it here. I can almost imagine the disbelief on your faces as you read this. I get it. I felt the same way when I moved here and discovered it all for myself. It can be a lot to take in, but trust me when I say it's world-shattering to see it in action. When I was young, I transferred from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln to Ohio State University in Columbus. I won't bore you with all the details behind the transfer, but I'll give you a quick rundown. I was a big fish in a small pond in Lincoln. I'd lived there all my life and gotten into a fair amount of trouble over the years. Up until Dad died, a few years after Mom, I was basically a perpetual college student with no real goals or direction. When Dad died, I realized I had no one to fall back on but myself. I was an only child, and my parents had also been only children. What little family still existed was spread out and estranged with no real way to contact one another. I knew that if I didn't break my routine and start over, I'd end up in jail, or worse. One day, out of the blue, I applied for a transfer to Ohio State. Not for any particular reason, to be honest. Ohio just seemed like a place someone would go to start over. Seems weird to admit it, but it's the truth. Some choices just don't have magical reasoning or logic behind them. I stayed away from frats and the party lifestyle in general this time around. I needed to buckle down and open some doors for my future. That got lonely real quick. The whole first semester I was there, I don't think I even saw my roommate more than 5 or 6 times. I went from a big fish in a small pond to a drop of water in the bucket, just like that. Before the next semester rolled around, I decided to check out what clubs were on campus. I figured it would be a great way to socialize while doing some resume building. You can find a club or group for pretty much everything at Ohio State, and the only problem I had was making up my mind on which one I wanted to join. Most of the clubs and groups had trial periods. You could sit in on a couple of meetings and check out what they had to offer before you made up your mind. I did this quite a bit until I landed on the one for me. It was the Urban Explorers Club. I was no stranger to urban exploration, of which my juvenile record can attest. I was something of a legend back home, although something told me this would be a little more professional than breaking into vacant properties to throw ragers. Still, it was nice to have some level of familiarity back in my life in any capacity. I'll make the introductions as quickly as I can. No doubt you've got something better to do than listen to me drone on with the life histories of everyone in the group. Jeff, the president of the Urban Explorers Club, was our fearless leader. He was a fifth-year senior and had been in the group the longest, although he claims it had been around for a long time. Apparently, it had been founded by his great-grandfather or some such. Next up was Alice, or Allie, as she preferred. She was the vice president. She didn't take shit from anyone and made sure we all toed the line when it came to the rules. Kyle was our safety officer. A lot of things can go wrong when you're exploring abandoned and often forgotten properties. It was his job to research the places we planned to explore and ensure a plan was in place for any conceivable emergency. He saved our asses plenty of times. That brings us to Nico. There's not a lot to say about Nico, really. He'd only joined the club a semester before I did and didn't talk all that much. He was a nice guy, though, and when he did talk, he somehow always knew exactly what to say in every moment. Then there's me, number 5. I rounded out our crew and was a much-needed addition, according to Jeff. Apparently, my lock-picking skills and general criminal history would come in handy. There were places that they'd wanted to explore but hadn't been able to, not until I came along. There was no shortage of places around Ohio to explore. It's a fairly small state and easy to get from one end to the other within a reasonable time frame. We even dipped into neighboring states from time to time if something worthwhile came across our radar. In less than a year with them, we hit all the most famous spots available to us. The group had been through at least half of them in the past, but claimed that they were always worth another visit. I could spend the better part of a day and still won't remember every single place we hit, so I'll make it simple and keep it to the top 10, in no particular order. 1. Helltown. 2. Peter's Cartridge Plant. 3. The Warner and Swayze Observatory. 4. The Cincinnati Subway. 5. The Iron Soup. 6. The Wagner Manufacturing Company Factory. 7. Moonville. 8. The Old Cleveland Aquarium. 9. The Molly Stark Mental Hospital. And number 10, Roseville Prison. No doubt some of these locations will either sound or be familiar to you. These days, many of them have either become too unsafe to explore, are impossible to get to, or have been demolished altogether. Each of them were amazing in their own unique ways, yet none of them are the focus of what I'm about to tell you. Of all the places the club had explored throughout their strange little history, one location remained unexplored. According to Jeff, it was their Holy Grail. It was the one place every generation of club members had dreamed of exploring, but for some reason or another was never able to. That was impressive to me, considering how long Jeff had claimed the club had existed for. Now, this location can't be found on any map. You won't find it on Reddit, Atlas Obscura, or any other source you can think of. The only mentions of it are in a small town somewhere in Ohio, which I won't name for reasons that will soon make sense to you. Even then, the only mentions are of the date it was built, the day it closed, and a few sets of blueprints that don't seem to match up to one another. So what's the name of this mysterious holy grail of untold adventures, you ask?
Marshville.
Yeah, you heard me right. Marshville. It was an entire little theme park that went out of its way to represent an enchanted swamp, or marsh, as the case may be. The real kicker? It was owned and operated up until the late 1950s by a company called Eldritch Amusements, based out of Essex County, Massachusetts. For those of you not doing a running count on the red flags here, we're up to three. One, it's abandoned. Two, it's swamp-themed. Three, there were some serious Lovecraft vibes going on that only I seemed to be picking up on. Marshville was like any other little theme park from back in those times. It was largely an over-decorated playground for families, complete with picnic areas and shelters. Sure, you had your basic fair-like rides and games, a simple Ferris wheel, and even a cramped wooden coaster called the Hydra. The Pièce de Résistance was a water-based ride that started as a log flume and ripped its way into a haunted swamp. Eldritch Amusements had gone with the name The Horror at Marshville Swamp. It was quite the mouthful, and even what little marketing there was back then had likely been a pain in the ass. Still, as far as dark rides go, it was about as unique as one could hope for, at first glance. That fateful day, we arrived not long after dawn with our gear and a can-do attitude. Some of the buildings scattered throughout the park were in such disrepair that giant sections of walls and roofs were missing. Others seemed as if they would crumble just by standing near them, and Kyle emphatically steered us clear of those. The buildings only took up a few hours of our time. It was enough to get some footage and collect the occasional worthwhile memento. In one of them, I found an old black baseball cap in a partially shattered glass case that was somehow untouched by the passage of time or Mother Nature herself. Other than a little dust, it was miraculously in perfect shape. It bore the name and logo of the park's coaster, which was just a reptile-looking creature with a long tongue and fangs. I brushed it off on my pants and plopped it on my head. I somehow wasn't surprised that it fit perfectly. We spent another few hours wandering the grounds themselves. How often do you get to explore an abandoned amusement park? We'd done a few, but none of them came close to the atmosphere of this place. Even the family aspect of the park was marred by creepy signage. One of the signs in particular really creeped me out. It said, "Unhappy is he to whom the memories of childhood bring only fear and sadness." On the sign was a little boy surrounded by his parents. They looked upon him as he cried with big fake grins and intense eyes. It had a real black hole sun sort of vibe to it. The playground and picnic area was just as interesting as the rest of the park. The playground itself was designed to look like a swamp. There were black, gnarly trees that held swings, twisted mounds of dark earth that led up to long, spiraling tunnel slides with mouth-like entrances, and seesaws created to look like toadstools and vines. It was all arranged more or less in a circle with a merry-go-round at the center. The merry-go-round itself was truly a sight to behold. It was a rusty, spinning death trap of overcrowded tentacles and bracken. Just looking at the thing could probably give you tetanus. I can only imagine how many bruises, cuts, and broken bones it was responsible for in its heyday. But at the same time, it was a marvel in terms of construction for the times. I'm not gonna lie, the rest of us took a few spins on it, to Kyle's dismay. The next stop on our little tour was the Hydra. Sections of the wooden track had rotted and fallen to pieces over the years, so there wasn't much exploring to do there. Mostly, we just walked the path of the coaster from the side to pay our respects. It was built back in the day where scenery really mattered, and there were plenty of statues and artwork, all Hydra-themed, to be found. We took some more pictures and videos before moving on to what we were really there for. Dark rides, or ghost trains if you prefer, have been around since 1901. Whether they were tunnels of love, mine rides, or spooky haunted mansions, they quickly found a place in the hearts of amusement seekers all over the world. Seated in a small train car, mine cart, or boat, you would be transported through a scenic journey inside a darkened structure from start to finish. I only know this because I read up on them when we started making plans to go to Marshville, just in case. It's always a good idea to know what you're in for. In all the research I'd done, I never ran across any of them that started with a log flume. The horror at Marshville Swamp was definitely unique. The log flume portion of the ride had suffered the same fate as the coaster. Large portions of it had rotted and fallen to pieces. In this instance, the wreckage among the trees was so dense that walking along the track wasn't even an option. We took what pictures and video we could and headed for the dark portion of the ride for a closer look. The first thing we noticed was a gate covering the entrance that had three different padlocks on it. They were fairly clean and free of rust. I pointed that out to Jeffrey, and he figured that whoever owned the property these days changed them out every now and then to keep people like us from coming in and making a mess of things. The dense woods and foliage surrounding the ride made it impossible to find another way in. It was all up to me to get us in now. I pulled out my lockpick set and got to work, only to notice it was a combination lock. I switched my main pick out for a hook pick and gripped the topmost lock in my hand, squeezing the shackle inwards towards the base to take the pressure off the locking mechanism itself. I'm willing to bet $50 that I can get us through all three of these locks in under 60 seconds. Any takers? I grinned back at my gathered clubmates. Bullshit, Kyle exclaimed. You're on. I'll get in on that action, Jeffrey added. Allie just shook her head, hiding a grin of her own. I'd actually been teaching her some of my skills over the last few months, and she knew better than any of them what I was capable of. As usual, Nico only watched to see how the situation would unfold. Prepare to be impressed, I warned. Okay, go, Kyle shouted, using his watch to time me. I slipped the hook pick in the space above one of the numbers and pressed down on the spring-loaded plate inside. The design on these specific locks, and no, I won't tell you which models, was poorly constructed. Within a couple seconds, the shackle popped open and I was on to the next. The second and third verse were the same as the first. I dropped the third lock on the ground and turned with a bow. That's time, Kyle said, consulting his watch. Looks like 38 seconds. Holy shit, man. Not my best time, but I'll take it. We'll settle up when we get out of here. There were chuckles and good-natured ribbing all around as Kyle opened the big gate all the way for us to peer inside. We were greeted with some thick fog and a faint greenish glow from somewhere beyond. It didn't take long to thin out with the door open. Once we could see clearly again, I noticed the greenish glow was gone as well. I assumed it had something to do with the reflection of the light against the fog or something. Jeffrey and Allie made their way to a strange contraption to our right, full of levers and some kind of pulley system. I've seen this before. If we pull the two center levers and spin the flywheel on the side, it'll get the water moving and the boats along with it, Jeffrey explained. We need someone to stay behind to operate the safety mechanisms to make sure nothing goes wrong, Kyle added. These old things don't have much in the way of safety mechanisms. Once you get them going, they're meant to pretty much operate themselves. The only thing we really need to do is switch the track over to let a few of the boats from the storage track out, and we're good to go, Jeffrey explained further. What about power? Allie asked before I could. The only thing the power would be useful for is to see the scenes as we pass them. This entire thing is powered by those levers, pulleys, the flywheel, and the water itself, Jeffrey went on. So, what if we want to see the scenery and not get swallowed into a dark hole? For all we know, there could be debris or something on the track, Kyle chimed in. That's why I brought the portable spots. I got three of those and two D-cell maglites ready to go. Jeffrey removed the heavy pack from his back and sat it at his feet. All right, I'll divvy out the lights. You get the boats rocking, Kyle said. It took about 15 minutes or so to get everything going. The levers were pulled, the flywheel was turned, and three boats were loaded onto the main track. A person in each boat got a portable spotlight. Nico and I got the mag lights. We were all set to go. Don't rock the boat! Jeffrey screamed at me, sweat beading on his forehead. I'd barely shifted in my seat, but that was enough to damn near dip the nose of the old track-driven boat into the murky water that surrounded us. There was only enough room for two people per cart. Kyle had elected to go alone for security purposes and had already begun his journey. That left Allie and Nico to bring up the rear. I could see Kyle's spotlight bouncing around and cutting through the darkness on either side of him up ahead, but couldn't make out any details. It wasn't until Jeffrey turned on ours that things became clear. Though no electricity powered the ride, the movement of the water seemed to trigger the animatronics via smaller water wheels and pulleys that were only visible to someone really looking for them. Luckily, Jeffrey loved this kind of stuff, so I was treated to some basic explanations and a lot of excitement on his part. While it was definitely interesting and kind of cool, I don't think I can do it any justice beyond this brief explanation. On our left, the initial scene itself was that of a swamp coming to life, albeit cartoonish in nature, complete with a frog catching a fly with its tongue while perched on the nose of a gator. The lack of proper lighting and music turned something that may once have been whimsical into a promise of dark tidings, the animatronics casting strange, pulsing shadows under the spotlight's influence as we bobbed along. Just up ahead on our left, the next scene came into view. It was an exact replica, save for one detail. A tentacle had broken the surface of the water, its tip shifting back and forth as if waving at us. This time, the shadows were still, despite the motion of our spotlight. On the right, another scene, another replica of the scene before it, for the most part. This time, the tentacle stood tall, towering over the rest of the scene. I had to assume that the missing audio would have explained all this somehow, though I can't imagine how it would have accomplished that. The strange, pulsing shadows under the spotlight's influence as we bobbed along had returned. This went on for half of the ride. The scenes always rotated from left to right, as these types of rides often did. In every scene, the tentacle was hovering over some other section of swamp, sometimes waving and sometimes not. Those pulsing shadows present only in every other viewing. At the halfway mark, something even more unsettling happened. The tentacle had begun attacking the wildlife, slowly dragging it beneath the water's surface. Each of the animals had a horrified look on its face in the respective scenes in which it met its demise, accompanied only by our bobbing spotlight and the sounds of water, worn belts, and squeaky wheels. The strange, pulsing shadows remained constant at this point, the light still somehow reacting with the animatronics that were no longer present. I was shocked out of my nightmare-fueled reverie when our little boat smashed into Kyle's. It had somehow shifted sideways and wedged itself into place. Neither Kyle nor his spotlight were anywhere in sight. Before I could fully process that, another boat crashed into us from behind. I shuddered inwardly as Jeffrey shined his spotlight behind us, already knowing what I'd find when I turned around. I took a deep breath and shifted in my sight to confirm my suspicions. Nico and Allie had disappeared as well. "What the fuck is going on?" I all but screamed at Jeffrey, panic welling up inside of me.
"This place is special, don't you think?"
Jeffrey's voice was almost melodic, something I'd never experienced from him before. "We bring someone here every year, someone no one will miss. Someone like you, Rudy," Jeffrey continued, now standing strong in the water's flow and shining the spotlight into my face. I raised a hand to shield my eyes from the blinding light on reflex. My brain was entirely failing to process the information being given to me.
"I can't imagine how confused you must be, Rudy, but this isn't a time for answers. The best I can offer you is this. Your death will serve a purpose here. Mother Hydra will be fed, and we will reap the rewards," Jeffrey revealed.
As his words ended, those animatronic tentacles rose all around me, gripping and ripping the boats on either side of me apart. Somewhere in the explosion of wood and splashing water, Jeffrey had disappeared, and that fog I'd seen when we first opened the gates began to fill the air around me. I flipped on the maglight and held onto it for dear life, having no idea what to expect. All I could do was keep my eyes peeled on the fog. I was in flight or fight mode, and the flight option had been taken from me. A scraping sound echoed throughout the ride and intensified quickly. Beneath it was another sound entirely. It was a sound I'd only ever heard in movies, all squishy and fleshy, the kind of thing a Foley artist would get from peeling off chunks of raw meat and rubbing them together vigorously. Next came the smell, all toxic and rotten. It made my eyes burn and water, clouding my vision. It burned my nose and throat, leaving a strange acidic taste in my mouth. Fear gripped my spine. Whatever this thing was had more or less disabled me, and I hadn't even seen it yet. And just as that thought settled in my brain, it slowly emerged from the fog before me. No description I can provide here will truly do it justice, though I'll do my best. It was all Rorschach and tea leaves to me, shapes that should make sense to my brain, but for whatever reason, didn't. Its structure was somewhere between melted wax, slime, and tentacles. Even if some semblance of shape was briefly recognizable, it was always shifting. The only thing that made sense was its mouth. As far as enormous, rotting maws full of goo-dripping razors made sense anyway. Unable to focus on the rest of its face, that's what I stared at. So there I sat, unable to move and facing my impending doom. In that moment, I did what any sane person would do in that situation. I pissed myself. Most of it was from fear, but there was a tiny little voice in my head that insisted it was in defiance. If it was going to eat me, the least I could do was make myself smell and taste less appealing. It scraped and oozed its way ever closer, until it was towering over me. It placed ancient tentacles on my shoulders and leaned in. The tea leaves and Rorschach shifted again, this time creating some semblance of a face as the center of its structure hardened. Two endless pits appeared where eyes would have been in a normal face. From them seeped the same greenish-yellow light I'd seen earlier. Two slits appeared below them as it leaned in to sniff me, its fetid breath overwhelming my senses between snorts. We were locked together, that creature and I, in a moment full of both discovery and terror. In a flash of disconcerting sounds and images, we were becoming one. I was it, and it was me. It was as if this meeting of minds was destined somehow, in some way my human brain couldn't properly fathom or decipher. In an instant, it knew my past, my present, and presumably the future I might have had. I knew its pain, hunger, and isolation. Without words, we made a promise to one another. Each would be the other's salvation. Slowly, the creature began to dissolve. I could feel it dripping on my skin, so warm and comforting. It seeped its way into my pores, and it filled me with a sense of belonging I'd spent my entire life searching for. It felt like home. When our moment ended, I moved through the murky water towards the end of the ride. I required no light, for I had become that which dwelled in the darkness, if not the darkness itself. There were debts that needed paying, and we were the collector. I fell upon our betrayers, our jailers, with a vicious fervor. I rended the flesh from their frames between breaths, the shock in their eyes fresh and unfaded. My tentacles swarmed them and plucked the bones from their shells, leaving discarded piles of bloody pulp in my wake. No pleasantries or long-winded diatribes were exchanged as I welcomed them to oblivion. We left that place and went on a several-day journey back to campus. Together, we roamed the open roads and tasted the flesh of freedom. The Urban Exploration Club was disbanded, and their remains were never found. We avoided suspicion and stuck around just long enough to finish our degree and move on. In some ways, we'll always be an explorer, urban or otherwise. There's always a new experience to be found, questions to be answered, sights to be seen, and flesh to be eaten. You've just heard Rorschach and Tea Leaves by Raz T. Slasher. Stepping aside real quick to ask, are you listening to this on YouTube right now? If you are, it really helps us out if you would drop a like and maybe even leave a comment. Thank you for helping us feed the machine. And now, also from author Raz T. Slasher, I present Mr. Jones and You. So long it's been since last we met. Although you may only remember me in your dreams or through the whispers of frightened little children, I was once just as much a part of your life as I am theirs. It's the natural order of things, the things that came long before and will exist long after. Things like me, we exist for a reason. We have purpose. Though that purpose isn't always clear, it exists nonetheless. Our existences are intertwined. Forever we are bound by the threads of fate. Such has always been the case, as it will always be. Not all that long ago, on a dark night such as this, you read a story about me, on Reddit or perhaps even in a book. It stirred something deep within you. It almost made you remember me. Alas, your adult mind would not allow it. Conditioned as it has been for decades now by society to lay all childish things aside. Before I continue, I must observe the proper etiquette. Things such as I are bound by the old ways, you see, a covenant between humanity and those of us that came before. In this case, the old ways demand I offer you a choice. This is a choice that should not be taken lightly. I once gave such a choice to a young boy named Aaron, to stay in his bed or be devoured. Although it took a while, he too sated my hunger for a time. I offer a similar choice to you now. Continue listening and have your memories of me restored, or cast this aside and cling to the ignorance that so many of your kind consider bliss. Both choices come with their own unique risks and rewards, revealed to you only once the choice is made. I shall extend my hospitality further by urging you to take your time with this decision and carefully consider all the possibilities. Are you sure you'd like to continue? You must be absolutely certain. Although you may have laughed or believed my warning to be in jest, I assure you that couldn't be further from the truth. The choice that lies before you could well change your life as you know it. Such a choice, once made, cannot be undone. I shall extend my hospitality even further still by allowing you one final chance to change your mind. Beyond this point, there shall be no turning back. 3 times I have warned you, and 3 times you have persisted. The promise of answers to questions you have only now begun to remember have brought you back to me, as I always knew it would. You have only yourself to blame. You were so young the first time we met. It was the middle of the night, and you'd just escaped your crib and fell to the floor for the first time. So clever and simple you were, to jump and scoot the substandard wooden frame several feet to the right and use the lip of the windowsill to pull your way up and out. It would still be another few weeks until your parents figured out how you'd done it. That first night, you fell hard. As your lip began to quiver, we made eye contact. So quickly, your pain turned to curiosity, and the jarring impact of your body bouncing off the tan shag carpet was immediately forgotten. The movement of a single finger brought you to me, so young and trusting you were. I sang a song to you, a song I would sing to you for many years to come. The words of that song still haunt your waking memories, although you can't recall from whence it came. No one ever does. Great green globs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey meat. Children are so fun to eat. I'll pull you down into a deep, dark hole. I can't wait to eat your soul. It's a shame I forgot my spoon. An odd song, certainly, but catchy and memorable to the precious few who have survived my hunger over the years. So many versions of it exist, remembered only as clearly as a broken psyche will allow, like a traumatic game of telephone played only for my amusement. Do you remember it now? Will you sing it for me, for old time's sake? I'll wait. Remember the night before your first ever day of school? By then, I'd been upgraded to imaginary friend status. I played the part well, always biding my time. I slid out from under your bed and wrapped my spindly fingers around the edge while you confided all your deepest fears and secrets with me. Would you make any friends? Would your teacher be nice? Were you smart enough? Did you pick the right outfit? I merely smiled and nodded a firm yes to your every question and offered words of comfort along the way. You thanked me. You told me I was your best friend forever. And you went to sleep with that stuffed animal you never went anywhere without. What was it again? What was its name? You know the one. That night that you told me all about the new friend you made on the playground. We talked about your teacher and how nice they were, but you weren't sure if they liked you very much. We talked about what you learned that day, how to write your name and cut colored construction paper with little scissors. you told me about the Pledge of Allegiance, the funny lunch lady in the cafeteria, and that one boy who kept getting in trouble but made everyone laugh. I remember you talking about him often after that. What was his name again? Do you remember? There was also the time your fish died. It was the first time you'd ever experienced death. You thought it was sleeping, the way it floated on its side at the top of the tank. It wasn't until it started to smell funny that you told anyone about it. And even then, you were so terrified that you'd be in trouble. They sat you down and explained death to you. They spoke about funerals and the afterlife. They wanted to flush the fish down the toilet, but you screamed and cried till they found a shoebox to put it in. For you, they held a small ceremony and buried it in the yard. It created a strange little tradition after that for each family pet who passed away. This is a part of your childhood you've never forgotten, and something that's still a part of who you are today. You cried so hard that night. You asked me if I would die someday too, and I assured you that I would not. You asked me if you would die one day, and I assured you that it was inevitable, but that you had a long life ahead of you. That was a lie, of course, or at least I believed it to be in the moment. You've proven me wrong since then, to my chagrin. You were meant to be my little fish. That fish, what was its name? Do you remember what it looked like? Do you find it strange that I recall so much about you? I remember so little of those I've devoured. They hold no interest for me. Those who manage to escape, those precious few, I find far more memorable. Among them, somehow, I find myself thinking about you the most. I relive our moments together, our milestones, and I relive my failure time and time again. You've become my obsession, and soon enough, I will once more become yours. Speaking of memories, what about the first time you truly felt pain? You were always an awkward child. You'd trip over your own feet if no other obstacle was available. That fall was the hardest, though. You still have the scar. It shocked you at first. You'd never felt anything like it. The blood rushed down your skin, and fire bloomed in your wound, far beyond the sting of a child's scraped knees. What was it you were doing again? How did you fall? What was the last thing you remember before it happened? You were in tears, still whimpering, when they brought you home from the hospital. You came straight to your room when you arrived, straight to me. Despite the friends you'd made at school, they were only school friends. I was your only real friend, as you often reminded me. You cried to me about the needle that numbed you. You cried to me about the needle that stitched you back together. You cried about the scar you knew would be left behind forever. Where is that scar? Do you remember how many stitches you got? Do people still ask you about it? Not long after that, you made a new friend. You met them at school like the others, but this one followed you home one day. I must admit, I was jealous at first. I worried that you'd outgrown me. I worried that my plans were for naught. You weren't ready yet. I needed more time. I pretended to be happy for you and encouraged you often. At some point, you began to confide in them more than you did me. Do you remember their name? I will never forget it. You lived in a town where people came and went. For one reason or another, it was common for people to move in or out with little warning. It wasn't the greatest area, but not necessarily the worst. Despite this, you were crushed when they didn't show up for school one day. Their phone had been disconnected, their home empty. You took it so hard, but I was there for you. You never knew that I followed them as they had followed you. My hunger was as endless then as it is now. Their name, what was it? It's on the tip of your tongue. I can tell by the look on your face. These things and more, I implore you to remember now. As you hear these words, I know you feel the tug in the corners of your past, your present, and your future. A flood of people, places, and things urging to breach the dam of conscious thought. I know this because I too can feel it. We can no longer deny our bond, our connection, nor the emptiness we lament in those places the other once filled. Yet, still, you doubt me. Even as the memories flow freely now, still, you refuse to believe. It's amazing to me, the capacity of the human mind, how easily your kind can dismiss things you do not understand or that you fear. Long now have you been conditioned by society, and the time for that undoing is upon us. Allow me to remind you further, in hopes that we can soon put this treacherous game behind us. Do you recall your first public speech in school? The one where you were forced to tell the class about your personal hero? You agonized over it for longer than you should have. There were so many choices, you said. So many who inspired you in some small but significant way. You barely possessed the vocabulary necessary for such a feat, yet you somehow surprised me yet again. You came home so excited. You were still nervous, though illogically refused to admit it to anyone but me. As if that would somehow change the way others saw you if they knew. Do you remember your childhood hero? Do you remember what you said in front of your class? Remember. You must remember. Because I will never forget. Not long after that, your obsession with the opinion of others blossomed. That was perhaps the toughest time of all for both of us. You were at that age of oblivion, that perfect age where wonder and maturity war with one another over the end of adolescence, the time when I would most often devour the flesh of those bearing my mark. Certainly, there were those moments when I believed all was lost. Just as there were moments where I was convinced I had you right where I wanted you. The only thing that became clear to me was that time was running out, one way or another. What came next only complicated things further. Do you remember the day that you fell in love for the first time? So clearly I recall it. Perhaps more so than any other memory I have of you.
you became so secretive, so distant with me. Perhaps you recalled your first friend, and some part of you began to notice the pattern of our relationship. It's possible there were things you'd begun to suspect me of, though if that were the case, you never mentioned it. I could feel you slipping from my grasp, and jealousy was a sour taste in my razor-filled mouth. Not jealousy on its own, but sorrow and anger as well. I'd never felt that way about anyone before, nor have I since. It bears repeating that you were, and are, different from the others. What makes you so different, so special? Do you know? Would you tell me if you did? This is important. Important that you recall your first love. There are things that you must remember before we can continue. I need you to picture them clearly now. What color were their eyes? What color was their hair? How tall were they? What was their body type? Build that image in your mind for me. Ah, yes. It's becoming all too clear. Now, tell me, what else do you remember about them? Speak the words out loud for all to hear. I'll wait. Leave no detail unwritten. Leave no stone unturned. Have you pictured them thoroughly? Do you feel confident in your mind's eye? Now, quickly, while it's fresh in your mind, scream out the words for all to hear. What was their name? Do you recall? You must remember. What happened to them? Do you recall? One day they were there, and the next they were gone. They left a wound deep inside of you at their departure. Do you recall those details? Do you still feel the empty space they left behind? The one you've never stopped trying to fill? Yes, you're nearly there now. I can see it in your eyes, though I am still hidden from you. Did you hear that? Just at the edge of your hearing? I'm getting closer now. Soon, we'll be together again. There was blood. Do you remember the blood? Can you see it clearly in your mind? They told you it was an accident. It wasn't an accident. Or rather, I was the accident. I could not stand to lose you, and I did what I felt necessary. I became a part of them in some ways, just as they became a part of me. A little louder now, that sound in the distance. The feeling that you're being watched should have just started to set in. Ignore it for now. None of that matters. What matters is what you're listening to right now. Don't stop listening. Don't look behind you. Don't turn away. Just listen to me. There are so many memories, so many little details etched in my eldritch brain. There have been times where I've adored you as one does a child. Times where I've hated you for being the one that got away. And times where I've loved you and mourned the relationship we once had. There are also those times, still, where you almost remember me when you first wake, as I lay in wait to greet you once more. The sound is steadily growing louder, but do not listen to it. I'm getting closer now, but don't look behind you.
Ignore the strange chill running up your spine. It's not important. Sing the song for me again. Do you remember the words? I'll sing it with you this time. Great green globs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey meat, children are so fun to eat. I'll pull you down into a deep, dark hole. I can't wait to eat your soul. It's a shame I forgot my spoon. Tap, 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 go my fingers on the wall now. Can you hear them? My long, spindly fingers, so impatient in their primal desire for your flesh. Does it remind you of that night? The night we parted? The night I held you in my grasp and changed you forever? Tap, tap, tap. Do not listen to the sounds I make now. That tap, tap, tap. Focus on my voice.
Focus.
Ignore the warm breath on the back of your neck and the way my feet vibrate the floor behind you with each step.
Focus.
Forget everything you thought you knew and remember the truth. Remember who you are.
Focus.
Through you, I shall be reborn.
Remember.
Through you, the world shall remember me again.
Remember.
No more closets.
Remember.
No more beds.
Remember.
No more dark spaces between the steps and the basement.
Remember.
Tap, tap, tap.
Focus. Remember. Sing the song. Sing it again.
Great green globs of greasy, grimy gopher guts.
Tap, tap, tap.
Mutilated monkey meat.
Focus.
Children are so fun to eat.
Remember.
I'll pull you down into a deep, dark hole.
Tap, tap, tap.
I can't wait to eat your soul.
Focus.
It's a shame I forgot my spoon. Remember, my name is Mr. Jones.
Tap, tap, tap.
Mr. Jones.
Focus.
Mr. Jones.
Remember, Mr. Jones.
Now, close your eyes and breathe deeply. I'll wait. Do you remember me? Do you remember my name? Say it out loud now. Mr. Jones. Do you remember my frog-like features? Do you remember my mouth full of razors? Do you remember my long, spindly fingers? Say my name. Mr. Jones. Do you remember my voice? So deep and soothing. Do you remember when I sang to you? Do you remember the time you trusted every word I uttered? Say my name. Jones. Tap. 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 Mr. Jones. Focus. Mr. Jones. Remember.
The time has come, my dear child, for a child to me shall you always be. Mr. Jones has come home to claim you, as you always knew he would. Now you remember. Now you know the truth. Now you have unleashed me once again upon this world. They will only have you to blame. See you soon. Tap, tap, tap. Breathe.
You've been listening to Mr. Jones and You by Raz T. Slasher. Raz T. Slasher is a modern-day bard influenced by horror and speculative fiction. He earned a doctorate in pop culture and a master's in creative writing. Find him at raztslasher.com, the Owl Light Network, and Hell's Dungeon Haunted Attraction. And that, my friends, concludes our broadcast evening. I hope that tonight's episode kept you nice and cozy in this late autumn. After all, the world outside is full of terrible things that are hungrily peering in through your windows. Thanks for sticking around with me tonight, and also thanks to Jay Lugo and Raz T. Slasher for their stories. As always, I'll be back next week with a fresh crop of dripping delights for you. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.